Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2019. This is the third night. This is the first hangout of the third night, and I am with Survive the Jive. Welcome.
Thank you, Colin. Great to be here.
Third night. Nah, don't worry. That was just my other window not muted yet. So yes, okay. Thank you for agreeing to appear. I think a lot of people have been excited. They always enjoy seeing you on Millennial. So.
Yeah, I always enjoy coming. It's been a tradition now. It's been for quite a few years. I've been doing it. Mm-hmm. I was on the first one as well, wasn't I? Is that 2015, wasn't it?
2015 was the first one, but I don't think you were on that. I think you were on 2016. You were definitely on 2017 and 2018.
There was a year I wasn't on it, but I think I was on the first year. I think the year I wasn't on was a different one. I think it was right, the second year I wasn't on and the first year I was or something like that.
Right, okay. It's different because the first year was a completely different format where it was chaotic, open, public hangouts, which each one of which happened to have a special guest. But even that happened by accident because Sargon gate crashed the very first one. So that sort of created this expectation of, well, who's going to gate crash the next one? So I had to arrange a special guest, and I arranged Spencer and Greg Johnson and the TRS guys and Jared Taylor. So it actually was born quite accidentally. But we're not going to talk about that or my channel or Millennial. We're going to talk about you and your channel and your experience of YouTube and social media over the last 10 years. So this will be quite, I think this will be a very interesting one and quite different from the others. But first, you have something to, well, first of all, somebody asked, can you explain the name Survive the Jive?
Yes, I can. I'll just say tonight, I'm afraid that I'm not drinking San Pellegrino. My friend
San Pellegrino is I am.
All right. You stole the sponsorship deal. No, I'm drinking gin and tonic now. So yeah, too bad, San Pellegrino. You missed the chance. But however, Gordon's Gin, I'd like to say I am open to negotiations. If you'd like to sponsor me, you know, we'll talk. Survive the Jive is a name. Was not a lot of thought went into it. The channel started in 2000. I opened the literal channel that I have now in 2006, but I didn't call it Survive the Jive until 2009. But the name Survive the Jive comes from the blog, which I also still have, which started in 2007. And that was called that because it was an anti-New Labour, anti-surveillance state blog. And the Jive was like an old-timey term meaning bad things. And it just was referring to the surveillance state and to not just the surveillance state, but also like the increasing technophilia of our generation. I'm a millennial. So at that time, 2007, I must have been 22 or something like that. And the first iPhone came out, and I was really, really against smartphones. I resisted owning a smartphone until 2013 when I got a Windows phone, a very crude smartphone, but since then my entire life has been catapulted into the very kinds of technology that I initially resisted. So I am, you know, fully immersed in a very technocentric, highly online guy. Hence, I'm just, you know, on this program right now. The old values of Survive the Jive as an anti consumerist, anti, or sort of techno-skeptic as well, I might use that term. Those are still there, but ever since around 2009, the channel and the blog have become more focused on religion, because I became more interested at that point in religion, and specifically ancient religions, as a way to look for alternative perspectives on life and being from the mainstream dialogue that what we normally see is normally accepted by both the left and the right in the mainstream as being normal, which is an unthinking acceptance of technology and so-called progress, that is the development of, you know, social and technological structures for their own sake without questioning whether, you know, what is the actual function of all this, what is the end goal.
And yet you have, even after all of that deliberation and contemplation on the matter, you've ended up becoming, as you say, immersed in it anyway.
Yes. And that actually, I think that the shape of Survive the Jive, like as I said, that the first 2 years, it was not really about technology, but the other, when it became the first 2 years was about this anti-technology, and it was more political and stuff like about global politics and geopolitics.
Would you describe yourself as left wing or right wing at that point? Because I can imagine left wingers getting into those topics as well.
Well, it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one to say that, because I mean, probably, I don't know. I definitely wouldn't be what you'd typically call left wing or right wing. I have always been anti mass immigration and always been pro Britain. So if that makes me right wing, then I've always been right wing. However, I should admit that during my teenage years before then, I did describe myself as a Marxist. However, I also had a really anti left wing habit. I just didn't like left wing people, and I thought that they were like dishonest and that the whole thing was posturing and nonsense. But also, I had this like somewhat naive kind of typically Marxist sort of romantic view of the working class as some kind of idealized form of humanity. You know, the heroic peasant kind of view. But I still, that was part of like an overall love of my country, which I've always had, even when I called myself a Marxist. But I don't think I was really like that in 2007. I just abandoned that sort of thing. I wasn't really right wing in any way. I wouldn't describe myself as right wing. I've had people call me right wing since I was like, you know, still growing pubes. I've always had that accusation, but I don't really care about what other people call me. But I suppose But the main thing is that my channel and my life became more focused into the way it is now, really over the course of the past decade, beginning in 2009.
Well, before we get into that, because I did only ask you what the word jive means in
just
we've,
bad
got,
stuff.
We've got a plan. We've got a plan for this. But before we get into that, so jive really does not, it has absolutely nothing to do with the more common thing that people might associate with that word, which is, you know, black jiving in America. It's actually, well, actually an old
the dance from what I understand, the dance of jive is white people used it to define a dance, because the black, for black people it was a pejorative, and so when they described the white, I don't know, I heard something like white people, it was a way of putting down white people, because they'd say, what do you call this kind of dancing? And they said, we call that jive, as in it's bad dancing the way you white people are dancing. But and then they called it jive dancing after that. But I don't know if that's true. But right, anyway. Okay.
All right. So what was the thing you wanted to plug?
Well, I have a book for Christmas time, The Spirit of Yule. It also has a cartoon version, which you can watch free online if you Google The Spirit of Yule. On the Smile Titans channel, who is the artist, very talented artist from Canada. And he and I made this book version of it available on smiletitans.com. It's suitable for children, and it basically is also for adults. It just tells the story of a Victorian guy who goes back in time to find out what Christmas was like in the pagan times. And he meets all like pagan people in a, you know, mead hall, and there's like a pagan Yuletide celebration. And in case you're not aware who I am, I'm a historian. So everything I say in that book about how the ancient pagans in England celebrate Yule is based on actual historical sources. And at the front of the book, I have a list of where I've sourced everything they do and how, so it's accurate. It's not just mumbo jumbo. So it's a great history lesson. It's not just for pagans. It's for anyone who wants to just have a fun ghost story, which is very Christmassy, and you can give to your kids and this, get them interested in their history and in their, and our heritage. And it's quite, I love that spooky kind of feeling about Christmas, ghost stories for Christmas. And we did a stream on that last year, actually, me and Wokes.
Right. Yes, we did. We did. Okay. So I will open this San Pellegrino, because we're hipsters, and I've also been given, by a friend, a vaping device, although I can't find it just now. But anyway, later. Ah, here it is. So this is I'm going to experiment with Parmaviolet vaping while you and I hipster the light away.
Is this a Yule Jewel?
Yes. So go for it, and we'll start talking about social media as it was in the 2000s, which, I mean, I remember LiveJournal. That was like the first blogging thing. It was a massive platform that suddenly everyone was talking. There was email in the 90s, Hotmail, and that kind of
MSM
stuff.
They had
yes, like chatting, ICQ, meaning
a messenger service that Microsoft used to run. That was cool. That was how I used to communicate with my first girlfriends when I was about 15.
Right, and then after that, there was what came after that? The ICQ was the chatting thing, and then in the early 2000s, there was blogging. And that was primarily LiveJournal, although I think there were others. And then you take it from there. What was your experience of social media from the early 2000s onwards?
Well, I'd like to go just skip all that and just talk. Can I just talk from 2009 about social media from then that development on? Because that's when I really, I mean, I didn't get into social media properly until around 2007 or 8. It's not so nice. It's not so good.
It's quite hard hitting. It's quite hard hitting. But what I mean, I think briefly, it would be good to just talk about the 2000s. I mean,
well, MySpace.
Were you ever into blogging? MySpace
was whatever I knew about before then. I don't really want to talk too much about MySpace. I don't have anything that interesting to say about it. But my first proper job. After doing like some, you know, I was doing freelancing as a journalist and stuff, but my first like a decent wage, you know, was from I was working in social media for a startup in 2009, which was the largest social media startup in the UK and supported by David Cameron and his initiative for the Silicon Roundabout.
Yes, that's what I was remembering. Yes, yes. And did that go anywhere? Did that?
Well, they pivoted and they used the platform for something else. My job was I was in sales and I was also support. I was manager support, and I was a sales manager, but I was also a support manager as well. So I managed a team in the UK and in San Francisco, and the platform had kind of a schizophrenic Jekyll and Hyde thing, because the way to they didn't do what like Tom from MySpace realized: make the platform big and then sell it. Just make it free and big and then sell it, and he got cash. Zuckerberg understood that data would be the thing, but these British guys I worked for, they thought that the way to make money is to use the same old-fashioned way everyone's always made money: you charge for a service. But obviously, people on the internet just don't want to pay for anything. They really don't. As we content creators realize, like a lot of people really don't, they really feel entitled to get everything for free. So it's quite hard to convince people to pay for anything. And I'm from that generation that got used to stealing everything online, like downloading films illegally. Not that I ever did that, but of course.
Of course not. Neither of us would ever do something like that.
Right. But many people did with Napster and whatnot in the old days. So, and it became, people got used to that. And the culture of the internet is kind of like everything should be free. A lot of people have an attitude. Anyway, the result is that they were finding the revenue model somewhat difficult, but they had another shadow side, which was a porn version of the same platform. And that was much more lucrative because a lot of people wanted to use the platform for pornography. And I had to have these clients speak to these porn clients, and each one could run a fetish site. I don't know. I signed an NDA. I don't know what I'm actually allowed to say, but let me just say that the kind of people and the kind of platforms that I encountered that they wanted to run, and interacting with them about the support for those platforms, was a big wake up call for me about humanity and what people are really like what's out there. Like some people get that from, you know, browsing 4chan, which is, I also discovered that around the same time, 4chan, about 10, 11 years ago. But there's some real sick puppies out there. And that was pretty bad. But black pilling, but also red pilling. I recognized that this social media stuff was the big thing, and it was going to be the future. And I was glad that I was working in it. And obviously, I also worked in video production for my first degree. And I started my YouTube channel earlier, but I was in the background all these double jobs. I was just trying to manage it and see if I could get good. I got my first big viral video. I uploaded in 2007. I mentioned this last year on our stream, I think, and it got to 750,000 views, and then I took it down. But so I did pretty good. Like most of my videos would go viral from the start, so I was pretty good at YouTube. from day one. I was, I think I had it figured out, but obviously the algorithms change over time. And now I can't do as well as I used to 10 years ago. So it's like, I'm not actually, even though my channel had hardly any subscribers then, you weren't aiming for subscribers, you're aiming for views. Now you're aiming for subscribers, but even the subscribers don't see the video. So it's weird. And
tell me about it. I mean, every time that actually is a good opportunity for me to plug something, because in every stream that I've done for Millennial, and this especially happened last year as well, there are people saying, I wasn't notified about this stream. So I want to plug this, my Telegram channel, which is MW Public. The link will appear in the live chat just now. And also there's a Twitter account, which is not run by me. It's run by a friend of mine, and Woz PA. That will also be linked in the live chat just now. And if you subscribe to one or both of those, you will always be notified immediately when a stream is about to begin. So there we go. But yeah, this is a big thing now, isn't it, Jive, that YouTube doesn't even alert it doesn't even alert your subscribers to your live streams, but also to videos that you put up. I was talking to someone recently about my video that I put up recently, the Turmoil Outer, and like the first of the two Turmoil videos. And he said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he hadn't even, YouTube had not brought this video to his attention, even though he was subscribed to me. And so I just had to tell him about it. This is, I mean, I don't want to go too much into this because it's well-worn ground, but it is weird. It is interesting that YouTube are now doing this. So take it away.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a while, I mean, there was this time when I realized suddenly that my initial thing was like, my initial strategy was make 5-minute videos. Obviously what you could upload then was different, and what people would be willing to stream 10 years ago was very much, it was all about short videos. And the first time I saw people doing like 1-hour videos and stuff, actually, you know, when I first it was around 2015, 2016, when I was watching you and people like Adam Wallace doing these really long streams, I was like, what are they doing? Like, who's going to watch an hour or something? I thought, I was sort of still stuck in that, boomerishly stuck in the idea that the optimum time was 5 to 10 minutes. And then I was seeing like these 1-hour things. And then, and at the time, and I saw that people were watching, but that at the time, YouTube hadn't changed its actual algorithm to favor long videos. And when I saw them, that they were doing that, then I was like, okay, from now on, I'm doing long streams. I'm going to do long videos because, that's what people will be pushed to. So it's become less organic. I think originally the reason the 5-minute format was favored is because that's what people actually wanted, not because that's what YouTube pushed. But there was this time when YouTube was deciding to push subscriptions. And when you had subscribed, even when I only had like 2,000 subscribers, I would upload the video and it would get like most of them would watch it, and like, or and it would spread to other people. So I'd get like 3,000 views when I had 2,000 subscribers. I was like, that's great.
Now, yeah, that's very, very good indeed.
But now I get like, you know, now I've got like 70 something thousand, and most of my videos get 10,000 views. So it's sort of weird that it's like that. And even when I look at the views of those 10,000, the majority of them are not my subscribers. They're still caused by YouTube. So YouTube's generating my views, but they're giving it as recommendations to people who aren't subscribed to me, which is interesting. So it's like, it's not like they don't want anyone to see my videos. It's just they don't want my subscribers to see my videos, which I don't understand at all what their strategy is. But it's hard to second guess and make a living off of it, which is...
That just sounds like it has to be a glitch somewhere.
I don't know. I mean, I want to, sometimes everyone says it's conspirational, they're trying to, you know, keep us off, but I can see that sometimes the algorithm works in my favor. It's just not in a way that I can second guess or anticipate. So like what I can do is hope that people subscribe to me or that they find my videos by search. But my videos don't do so well by search and they're not often shown to my subscribers, but I still get quite a lot of views. And that's not from search or subscribers. That's from recommendations. So YouTube is helping me, but also hurting me at the same time. So I don't know.
I think one of the things is that now, and I don't want to go too much into the technical stuff at the side of this, but one of the things now is that YouTube doesn't show what your subscriptions have been up to recently by default. Like when you go to YouTube, it doesn't show your what you've been doing, what Golden One's been doing, their latest videos, it shows you some recommendations from across the entire website. In order to see what your subscriptions have been doing, you actually have to click on subscriptions.
Yeah.
That it like a year ago, it wasn't like this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is maybe
the trending page has been since they launched it. It's just rubbish. I mean, I quit watching TV in 2012. And because by that time I was watching YouTube mainly and nothing else since then. And and in those times it was still like you could get, you know, a lot of content. I had so many subscriptions and I'd see all of them in the subscriptions feed. And now it's like if I click my subscription feed, I just don't see. I haven't unsubscribed from anyone, but they're just not. It's just not there anymore. It's just not how it used to look. Like I'm not seeing all the content from the same people I used to see. Maybe some of them been deleted, or maybe they just don't show them anymore. I don't know. But it's frustrating. And I'm not just talking about as a content creator. It's as frustrating as a viewer, as a fan of some of the other channels that I like. I want to see their videos, and I don't see them. And I can't remember where to find them or how, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like they're trying to push us back into the old media thing. But this has been said by many people. But we've seen over the past 10 years, looking back at this decade, this rise of this alternative perspectives, and then subsequently a kind of push down again to try and like suppress what was.
Well, it's YouTube is actually murdering its own USP, which is amazing to see happening. And this is, I think, testament to the power of the people who own the mainstream media and their influence throughout the culture, mm-hmm. and maybe even their ties with Silicon Valley directly, that they are able to persuade YouTube, okay, you're famous for independent content creation, but why don't you murder that? Why don't you thwart that, throttle it, and replace it with the Hollywood stars and cable news networks instead.
Yeah, that's amazing. Again.
But why don't you talk about what YouTube was like when you first started? Because for some reason, I struggle to remember what YouTube was like before I became a YouTuber at the very end of 2013. And people say, like, for example, one of the things that I was talking to someone else earlier about today is response videos used to be a thing. And also that YouTube got rid of that just before I started. And another thing was that you could customize your channel far more. So can you talk about what YouTube was like when you first started in 2007? I think that was just after the website began. No,
the channel itself, I opened in April 2006. You can see on my channel details. So right. I deleted all the videos from 2006 that I uploaded. So don't look for them. But you can see the channel's creation date is there. It's April 2006. So that was, I think it was the channel was the first video was uploaded to YouTube in 2005, I believe. And I was at the time doing video production in Brighton University. So I needed somewhere to upload videos anyway, because at that time there were only places where you had to pay for uploading video. And it was really annoying if you had videos that you wanted to share. Because you had to, you know, especially if you're a student, you've got no money. And then when YouTube was available, I was like, this is brilliant. I just dumped a lot of videos on there. And I used to use it to just dump videos on. And it was very slow to upload. It was a bit like BitChute in the sense it was a little bit clunky and buggy. But it was the best option. It was great, in fact. I couldn't believe it was free, that they host all these videos for free. And the social aspect wasn't really that big to start with. Like, I wasn't that bothered about no one really cared so much about subscribers, and it wasn't really social media. It was just a video hosting thing. I think it gradually cottoned on to the fact that it could be a social media site. And it was like people were sharing YouTube videos on social media sites when Facebook started to get big in 2007 and 2008, stuff like that. And before Facebook had its own video platform, it was much more like you post videos from YouTube. But then YouTube gradually became a bit more like Facebook. Facebook gradually became a bit more like YouTube and everything. And they start to try and, you know, isolate themselves from each other a bit more. But I suppose it was more integrated before. The comments section things, I remember like the kinds of videos that were on when I was still at university in 2006 and 2007, YouTube's videos. There was a lot of conspiracy videos on there quite from the beginning. And I enjoyed watching those. I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but I always enjoyed watching them. And all of them had, they all had that song from, is it from Requiem for a Dream or The Matrix, like, and then like triangles coming on the screen and stuff, but really pixelated. And all these like things like that. I'd enjoy those quite a lot. But
obviously that was when Zeitgeist was taking off, that kind of thing.
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Zeitgeist. Remember that?
Is that really? Was it one of those conspiracy films?
Right? Oh yeah, it's one of those. Like, I think it was about 2008, 2009, and that was a massive thing. Loads of people were talking about that, and I can't even remember really. I think it ended with reaching the conclusion that basically everything's connected.
Yeah.
Standard
it's
thing.
It's a lot of paranoia and that kind of stuff. It was just silly. I just found it fun. I didn't really believe any of it, but I mean, there are some certain. We'll put it this way, some of the things that were that would come up on those algorithms turned out not to be conspiracy theories in the end. But so there was a kind of way you could find, you know, threads and come to interesting content that you wouldn't be able to now. They put a stop to that.
Well, but they've explicitly gone against conspiracy channels and conspiracy. Yeah. That whole sector of YouTube is now verboten. They're trying to get rid of it all. But someone's asking, so you don't believe in conspiracy theories. Did Epstein kill himself?
Do you want me to actually say anything? Because are they going to shut down your channel for if I talk about, if they say I give unofficial history or anything? But
yeah, maybe good point. Okay, then. All right. Let's not risk anything just for that. Let's just assume that Epstein did kill himself.
Well,
yeah.
Okay, so
I'll just calmly have another draw on this Parma Violet vape and hope for the best. So keep going.
Yeah, and gradually the social media aspect came in. I think that's when subscriptions became more important, because then you weren't just watching videos, you were watching channels. You really were like tuning in to this person that you and also like gradually a format developed and became popular of like what people call now vlogging, where it was like this frame. I learned all the lessons about how to, you know, what shots to use in film, what shots to use in television at school, film school, whatever. But then this thing emerged for YouTube, which is completely different, which is that close-up face all the time, like now, like this shot of us. So you're I'm at extreme close-up, you're at medium close-up. Those are hardly meant to be used at all in television or cinema. But in YouTube, because a lot of people watch it on their phone, everything changes. Now, so the format changes and the way the videos edited were different and for different kinds of... So YouTube, the format itself, nothing to do with what the company owners did, but it online video necessitated a new form of interaction with the video medium itself, and that meant that editors and content creators evolved the way, you know, with the technology itself, which is a very interesting development. And of course it's not always good, because sometimes I notice also like a kind of very fast and unpleasant editing style and a kind of speaking very quickly, very about very little, and like with an overly exuberant and fake, you know, fake joy. I found it very unpleasant. And when I started creating specific YouTube content for the channel, especially around 2009, where I wanted to talk about specifically Anglo-Saxon, but also more widely European traditions, like ancient pagan stuff, about our heritage, about why we as British people should be proud of our heritage. And I wanted to do it in a slow way, with slower talking, slower editing, slow music, not drums and beats.
Honestly, I mean, if you've got any sort of charisma at all, it's fine just to, you can do it. You don't need fast editing and ridiculous, you know, sound effects and all that. I really don't, you know.
You're one of the channels, actually, that struck me as being, as also bucking that trend, which has been the main trend for all of YouTube, which is that the more cuts there are, the faster you speak and the more, what's the word for that kind of, you know?
Frenetic.
MTV, sorry?
Frenetic would be the word.
Yes, like that kind of MTV personality, like grinning teeth all over the place.
ADHD sort of stuff.
Yeah, like it's unpleasant for me to watch. I find it irritating to speak to people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are people I wouldn't, channels that I shan't name, but I find them very difficult to watch. If somebody links me to a video by someone, I really struggle to watch it because I find it so obnoxious and aggressive and dizzying. It's like a constant barrage of cuts and stupid statements and so on.
It's like being trapped in a pub with a bunch of people on pills or something. But my idea was that, and obviously I was thinking I wasn't trying to make a living off of it at the time because I had a full-time job and I was sort of happy with that. And I was just like, I'll do this on the side. And my feeling was that this was me just helping the world a little bit by making some content available that not everyone knew about and doing it in a way that I wanted without any compromises. I was not thinking about the audience at all. I was only thinking about myself and what I like. And I didn't give a damn if the audience liked it or not. And not that many people did like it. So that was the effect. But a few people really did like it, a small number. And I did have that.
So you also started as, you know, like I did. And like there was somebody else who appeared yesterday who was saying the same thing, that he started this channel not intending to live off it. The Iconoclast. It was just something that he did in his spare time. And then it became... Over time, it became a far bigger part of his life and eventually his career.
Right. That's exactly true. Except that I did have an intention that my main objective one day was to be able to make money off of being either a filmmaker or a historian. But I ran the channel in the background, never thinking that that would be the way that I could do that, because it was never in my, I would never dream that YouTube would be a viable way of making a living. Because I saw it as just a frivolous, you know, at best something that people can hear about who I am. And then I would get a job. I've had several interviews with the History Channel and BBC and stuff like that from other things. So I've tried to break into the mainstream, which was my intention. I don't think that's ever going to happen now. But in those days, that was mine.
I think our goose is cooked in that regard.
Yeah.
Sad, well, but there we are.
Yeah, last time I had a chat with History Channel was in May this year. So they sometimes think about using me again, but then I guess they always decide not to. But the channel grew, and I just kept on adding to it and getting better. And you know, by 2014, when I was living in London, people started to recognize me in the street, and I only had less than 2,000 subscribers, but it happened quite a fair bit. Not that much, but especially if I attended an event with right-wing people. Now, that was interesting because I never made any right-wing content, but it was only when I went to right-wing events that people recognized me. And I realized that naturally my content was mainly appealing to right-wing people, not because I had any political content, just because mainly right-wing people are the people who start to question, why don't we celebrate our heritage more? And then they look for that kind of thing.
Just to be clear, you got recognized out in real life when you only had 2,000 subscribers.
Right. Now, I need to look on Social Blade to see exactly when. But I remember I was recognized when I had less than 2,000 subscribers.
That's amazing. The first time I got recognized, I had about 18,000 subscribers. That was in America, in Portland, Oregon. And that was the first time for me.
I think I got recognized several times at events before I had 2,000 subscribers. And I got recognized once after I went first time on Red Ice in 2015. I was recognized in the street in London. Who said someone saw me? Oh, I saw you on Red Ice. And when I first went on Red Ice wasn't actually a right-wing broadcaster either. Neither that was when they were still mainly a alternative religion and things like that.
Conspiracies
and things like that. Yeah. So they were. That was when there was this transition happening for some people, and they were, you know, moving into a political sphere by necessity. But then in Sweden, I got recognized a lot because even though it's my third biggest audience after America first, then Britain, and then Sweden, in Sweden, I get recognized a lot because it's a tiny country in comparison. So like the whole country has about the same population as London, roughly. So it means that like the concentration of people who are Survivor Jared fans in Sweden is much higher than in other countries. So I still hardly get recognized in UK, even with 70,000 subscribers. It's very uncommon for anyone to recognize me. But I went up to Sweden last Christmas and I got recognized in the street a couple of times. So it's funny that. So But yeah, I think the channel, that was a kind of sweet spot around 2015 with 2016 was that way the channel with the way the platform of YouTube worked. I liked it a lot. I liked the way I used it as a consumer, as in consuming other people's channels. But I also enjoyed it as a creator because I don't think there was any funny games. And if I wasn't getting views, it was because I was doing something wrong and there wasn't any funny business on their part.
Yes, at that point it was very straightforward. You knew how to do it, and as long as you're putting out good stuff, your subscribers would like it, and it would reach new people who would become new subscribers, so your channel would grow. And it was just a very sort of linear, straightforward thing. Nowadays you've got, I mean, just this thing about the notifications. It's just one example of how, in fact, I made a list of all the little ways that YouTube tries to fuck you over. And since we're talking about this,
can we hear some of these? I think now you've mentioned that everyone will want to hear.
Yeah. Okay. Because this was an ad. I don't know if it's safe for me to say this, but I was given a YouTube survey, content creator survey. What do you think of your experience of YouTube? So I chose, and then it asked you to explain your answer, and say, okay, you're not that impressed by it. Why aren't you? What's your beef? So here's what I said. The rules are applied randomly. This is quite a long list of complaints. The rules are applied randomly. Channels are terminated without warning or second chances. Reasons are invented for striking and terminating channels. For example, I had some uninitialized hangouts, which was suddenly deemed spam and deceptive practices and earned my channel a strike. I mean, that was just never a problem before, that suddenly it was. Appeals often take forever or are simply ignored. There is no ability to speak to a human being. Demonetization includes losing Super Chat, even though Super Chat does not affect advertisers in any way. You claim to be pro-free speech, yet you punish and ban people for voicing alternative, controversial or offensive opinions. You disable notifications for subscribers of channels that you don't like and demote those channels from search results and recommended lists. You do everything you can to sabotage channels that go against the grain, up to and including terminating them and thus destroying their owner's livelihood. Additional, you punish people for violating new censorship rules with videos that they published years before those rules were implemented. And you enable flagging raids, e.g. 3 overlapping strikes and your channel is gone. And there's an immediate succession of warnings and strikes, leaving no possibility for the channel to be fixed and therefore survive in between those strikes. It's just constant succession. That happens as well. So that's just, and I'm sure that there are more things that I could have thought of, but that was the list that I thought of off the top of my head when I was doing that survey. And then afterwards I thought, well, I'll copy that for posterity because it is quite comprehensive.
And there are other things, I guess, that smaller channels experience that we don't, because you have to reach a certain hump before you get certain privileges. Like, you couldn't even upload any videos longer than 15 minutes for years, like on YouTube, and unless you had like a certain amount of whatever of subscribers. And then finally that stuff came in, and I know that now small channels, they assign a different codec to your videos, so you can't actually upload HD content until you reach a certain level. But who's going to watch a channel that's all got blurry videos? So
right.
So it's very hard to make it, to get started now. And I had a difficulty with my Anatolia film that I uploaded, and I checked and they did assign it the high codec, but they added all these artifacts to the, there was digitization of artifacts to some of the video, like, you know, distortion, digital distortions. And yeah, I tried re-uploading. It was an H.264 format, but I checked on the original file and I even re-exported it and tried re-uploading, and they added it. So I don't know what's going on. I never used that. I mean, so I complained, of course, but you've got no one to talk to. You've got no one to talk to at all. I like the fact that in Germany they're actually trying to start a YouTubers union.
Good idea. Absolutely. I'm very up for that idea. And it dismays me to see the attitude among the Anglosphere towards this union, which is, oh, I don't want to get roped into anything. I'll just fight them on my own. She does stand a chance of winning that. I mean, you're simply signing your own death warrant with that attitude. It's something to do with the Anglosphere, I think, this individualist thing where you just refuse. Any idea of collective action gives some people the heebie-jeebies, and so to speak. And so they don't do what they need to do in order to... I mean, I'm convinced. I basically think at this point that we are finished on YouTube because content creators refuse to collectivize. They refuse to unionize. And the example in Germany is a rare example where it does seem to be happening, and I wish them the best of luck.
God, imagine how many, forget like right-wing channels, but if you just said all in Britain, and let's just think about Britain, I have to pay taxes. I got to declare every single penny I make with YouTube. I declare it, and the tax man takes it. It takes all my money away as normal. Well, I'm employed, and there's many, many hundreds of. I'm in the top 6,000. I think I'm in the top 6,000 YouTubers, apparently, according to Social Blade in Britain, which is not bad. But what are they? Over 6,000. How much are they earning for the country? How much are they paying? And there's no bloody union. Like, why is it? Why is it like it's a very slow adaptation to a new form of
yes.
This is the way that people are. This is how people are consuming media now, and it's not like YouTube popped up last night. I've made the channel in 2006. This is old technology now. This is old thing. This is an old way of
making. Yeah,
and there's not. It's like the boomers haven't figured out that this is like there are people making money on this. The people paying taxes money with the money that they earn, and they have no legal representation. They have no they have no union or anything. They have no workers' rights, which apparently are things that matter to the left in certain circumstances, but not in others.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm basically resigned to it now that I'm going to lose my channel. Everyone, you will eventually lose your channel. We're all going to lose YouTube, and it's because. People refuse to collectivize. And I tried for a long time to motivate various people who are much bigger than me in terms of their channel, their subscriberships, trying to motivate them to do something, and they just refuse to do it. So I can't do it. I can't lead this. If I could, I would, but I don't have the clout to do that. So I've just given up. As far as I'm concerned,
for the next decade, you're thinking that the future of Millennial Woes is BitChute or
yes
podcasts or what?
BitChute, at least initially. I'm sure, I don't know what it will evolve into. I might not even use that name anymore. I mean, I don't want to get too deep into this because it gets kind of existential and so on.
Perpetual Woes.
possibly. Again, that's another thing. Maybe I'll want to evolve beyond that notion of... sadness, disappointment, and so on, because eventually it might become a bit of a prison. And in some ways, it has been a bit of a prison already. Right. But anyway, who knows what I will do in the future. But I think for now, for the immediate future, what I'm looking to is BitChute, because we're doomed on this platform, on YouTube. I just don't see any other... I don't think that can be denied at this point.
Well, I'm gonna say counter signal you and say that in what my channel's become, I don't think that makes sense for me, because although my BitChute channel is probably equivalent to where I was in 2015 on YouTube. So I mean, I could probably grow it much faster than it took me to get from where now, but I can probably, make a living through other things carrying on BitChute. But the point of my channel is to make information widely available that a lot of people don't have otherwise, and to encourage people to feel joy and pride in their heritage. And I think that a lot of people who would pursue me on BitChute don't really need any convincing of that. They're just sort of they're wanting the they enjoy the videos, and it's providing entertainment for people who agree with me, which is not really my primary objective, which is nice. I do like to provide entertaining videos for people who agree with me, but what I really want is to provide what I get a lot of the messages I feel really proud about when I get emails and messages from people saying that they had a completely different view of the world until they encountered my channel. And that can only continue to happen when it's for as long as people like that can stumble across it.
Oh, absolutely. And this is going to be the big bummer of if, as I predict, we're going to lose these access to the mainstream platforms. Yeah, it's going to be a bit of a ghetto, but we're going to have to hope that people from the general public are inclined to visit that ghetto and find out what's there. I don't like it, and I can tell you don't like the idea. I don't like it either. This is not something that I'm glad is happening. I just see it as an inevitability because there is not the will to launch, for example, lawsuits. There should be class action lawsuits against Google for, I think it's called tortious interference, sabotaging a person's livelihood.
Is this British you're talking about?
It would have to be in America since these are American companies.
Okay.
But
well, they operate in the UK, so
they do. So maybe they're subject. I'm sure they are subject to British law as well. I think that all of this should be looked into. We should have an organisation that is concentrating all its effort on doing this, on looking into the legal options for suing YouTube and Google. Of course, what everyone always says is you can't go up against them. It's Google. They're massive. They've got all these resources. But actually, that seems to me defeatist. They are subject to the laws of the countries in which they operate. So we can use those laws against them. And if we can't, then it's time to campaign to change the damn laws.
I mean, you're right. It would be... But it's a shame that like it's hard to get people to. I don't think, to be honest, it can be led by as people. It can't be led by me, a minor history channel of somewhat questionable authority in recent times, and or you, who are a political dissident. It needs to be led by a more mainstream YouTuber in Britain.
I agree.
PewDiePie was a UK taxpayer, so I think he might have relocated to Japan, but he could have been a leader for it before then.
Of course, and this is something that I'm surprised the alt-right are not taking up as a project. Like, this should be all that they're concerned with and should have been all that they've been concerned with for the last 2 years. And yet, they are far more, it's weird, they're far more defeatist. The alt-right are a very passive, there's a very stark, and I don't want to like attack the alt-right, but there is a stark divide in terms of, like, the alt-right was and is, if that term is still relevant, a very masculine thing. It's very sort of aggressive and sometimes autistic, and sort of decisive and independent, fiercely independent and anti-social movement. The alt-light is far more feminine and it's far more social. It's far more friendly, sort of cuddly, but it's also far more go along to get along. Just to carry on the analogy of the feminine. And so I don't think it has the people who inhabit that movement, I don't think have the balls to really go against the grain and actually rock the boat. I don't think they're going to do it. I think
it doesn't have to be alt-light at all. It doesn't have to be any kind of political channel.
But they are the ones, they are the obvious candidates to do this. And I'm trying to analyze why aren't they doing it.
Oh, I see. Well, I don't know. I think that a lot of people think that no one wants to be the one to. I guess it's how you know. No one wants to be the one who get Google's axe on their neck. So they just want to be. They'll be happy if someone else gets a union together, but you don't want to be the one who stick your neck out.
Exactly, exactly. And this is why I do admire. What is it, Jorge Sprava. For the German guy who's spearheading this effort to create a union there. He said that it will, anyone, you don't have to be German to join this union. Anyone can do it, but I don't know how effective it will actually be. I don't know, will they defend the likes of, well, me, for example, or would I be way beyond the pale?
It's a union, right? So if they get legal victories, whether or not what happens in Germany has any legal impact in Britain is what I would be worried about, but I don't know. I don't, yeah.
It's strange. I just think that there's so much that could be getting done, and it's just not getting done. And
in terms of YouTube.
Yeah, but what, YouTube, but all of the whole social media thing.
Is your objective for the next decade? Do you think your online objectives, or even next year?
I see it as that's a really complicated question. And again, I don't want to make it too much about myself because this is really supposed to be about each of the guests. But I see that I think that there's a need for cultural change, and I think that there's probably a just under the surface of British life, I think there is a sort of thirst for something new, something that does not have the rainbow flag attached to it, because the rainbow flag is attached to everything new straight out of the gate. Mm-hmm. So, which is part of how the progressive paradigm is constantly maintained and replicated. So, I think there's something. There's a need for something that is beyond what we have. What the alt-right, the alt-light, all of that. I think is kind of in 2016, 2017 at this point. And then people talk about the Groypers now, but even that is not new. It's not radical. And I think that there is a need for, I mean, the free speech movement in Britain a year ago really excited me for this reason, because they didn't really know what they wanted. They just wanted an open arena in which to think about ideas and discuss things. But even that was like the hammer of censorship came down on that from the likes of Hope Not Hate and so on, because they understood as soon as people have freedom, as soon as there is an open arena, they are going to say things that we don't approve of. They're going to think thoughts that we don't approve of. So, and I think the people who were behind that free speech movement in Britain understood this, that they were up against somebody who was trying to censor them and control them, and they resented that. And so that excited me, because it wasn't expressly political or right-wing or nationalistic, but it was a clamour for intellectual freedom. And I thought that there's a huge amount of potential there for cultural change and just cultural activity. But it seems to have died a death, partly because of censorship. I mean, all of the people who spoke at the Day for Freedom event last year, most of them have been deplatformed since then. It's quite staggering, actually, when you look at what the positions that they had at that point. They were still major social media figures. Now most of them have been banished from social media, or at least they don't have the clout that they had then. So it seems to have died a death, and I'm very disappointed by that, because I think so much needs to happen in Britain, and this is the kind of thing that I want to think about. Like, as I said in my recent videos, that I'm kind of bored with politics, I'm kind of bored with the topic of identity, and I think it's all been said from my point of view. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be continue to be said. I just want other people to say it now. I want to move on to something more fresh. So that's my plan for the next couple of years. As for the next 10 years, I don't know. I think the world in 10 years is going to be far more turbulent than it is now, and we probably won't have the luxury to think in these terms 10 years from now.
What do you mean fresh? Like, you mean something fresh for you, something fresh like in the ideological plane, like in general?
Something just culturally fresh, not even ideological, just like when in the 70s when punk came along, that was fresh. In the late 60s when the hippies came along, yes, it might have been controlled by the US government and whatever, don't know, but either way it was fresh. I think what was the last fresh thing that happened culturally? I mean, the 2000s was a dead zone. The 2010s was really just an empty rehashing of previous things. You know, I think there is a need for new honesty and new life. And because the progressive paradigm is so rigorously enforced, there cannot be any honesty. One of the videos that I toyed with making last year during my hiatus was about how the trans thing necessitates dishonesty, because I don't need to go into the details of it now, but it's just one example of how this happens. In order to be progressive, you have to be dishonest. In order to be too ideological in any direction, you have to be dishonest. But the ideology that happens to be in vogue just now and in force just now is progressivism. So everywhere people are being dishonest, everywhere there is a lack of connection between the thoughts people have and the experiences that they actually experience, between thought and feeling, you might say. So that has to be addressed. And it seems inevitable to me that I am not alone in feeling like this. I think it must be a fairly widespread feeling of dislocation, disconnection between, between society and the individual because of the way society alienation.
Yeah, it's like we don't feel connected to the things. We don't feel connected to the most people don't feel a great deal of connection to the world that they actually, work in, the labor that they do and then the value of that labor. But that's what the Marxists have always said.
Oh yeah, but I'm not talking about that.
Also about the media and the fictional and entertainment world, like the cultural world that is presented to us, which is supposed to be our culture, but isn't really. It's a product that we're being asked to purchase, but we don't want it.
That's the disconnection that I was referring to. The fact that culture today seems to be artificial and dishonest and bizarre and perverse and unhealthy and unhelpful. Right. It doesn't help you. It's fucking ridiculous.
You were originally an art graduate and you have a variety of skills in media production, synth and music and video. So there's a lot of things you could do with those skills to try and create something of cultural worth for people and not necessarily under the millennial woes heading.
Yeah, indeed. And I'd rather it might be that millennial woes needs to be retired because it's got too much baggage. People associate it with politics. I don't want my future work to be political. I never did want it to be political. And I didn't ever see myself at the start as a political dissident or a political activist. So that happened sort of by accident.
Dissidents probably become dissidents by accident. By sticking to their guns, they necessarily become enemies of a state that requires everyone to go along with what they say.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of people, that's very typical. A lot of people in our movement don't intend to be political and are not trying to be expressly political or explicitly political in their work or even implicitly political in their work. But their work offends, the left. So it becomes political by necessity.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the same with me. My work is not political. It's literally just history videos. Like, starts off with just videos talking about how to say this word in Old English. What's the name for a crow in Old English? Stuff like that. And it moves on to other things. But it is definitely regarded as political by all kinds of different people. It's hand-wringing intellectuals, activists of various kinds. And I know that the Marxists have a theory that everything is political. But I don't like that view. And I don't think we should go too far along with it.
Yes, I agree. Is
political. Like, I mean, to an extent, they're right. Because in terms of Marxism, you're either a Marxist or you're not. And if you're not a Marxist, then you're an enemy. So in that sense, anything that is not explicitly Marxist is potentially a threat to them. And I shouldn't just say Marxist because that's simplification, because it's not the problem isn't Marxism in the conventional sense anymore. It's something more amorphous, less easily defined. In fact, they're quite openly capitalist in many respects. So they're certainly not Marxist.
This is why I use the term progressivism or globalism. These two words.
Globalist is better, yeah.
Yeah.
Globalist or globalist neo-Marxist, whatever term we give, everybody knows exactly what we mean. Even though I don't refer, when I say Marxist, I'm not referring to an old guy in a donkey jacket waving a copy of Das Kapital necessarily. I'm talking about all this crazy stuff that we're seeing all around us all the time. And a lot of those people are multimillionaire, capitalists. So, these people are right, though, that everything is political to an extent, but only in a very certain paradigm. I don't really think politics is that, it's not interesting to me, actually. What I find interesting is culture and that's what I wanted to focus on, and the history of culture and stuff like that. And I think that, That's what I'm going to do for the next decade anyway. Whatever happens, I'm going to keep doing it. And it's not like I can do anything else now. So,
well, exactly. That's a part of it where you end up, and I talked about this in my Acedia and Crisis videos in October last year. I talked about it in the Turmoil videos this year. You're in this position. You and I are in this position where we have to stay in this because there probably isn't anything that we can do because the Marxists, the cultural Marxists have sullied our names. Now, I'm not moaning about this situation. I'm just sort of characterizing it, just like, noting this is the situation. So we have to stay in this. And and it's all a bit, we have to find a way forward, basically. And I think that some of us are going to go into just pure politics. That's fine. Political activism, whatever, fine. But I think that some of us, namely, including you and me, are more probably better at the cultural stuff. And that might mean distancing ourselves from the politics because that gets in the way. I think that politics, it kind of sullies everything because it forces you to be fairly black and white about everything and prescriptive, doctrinaire. You have to constantly be advocating this or that or something. And, like, I don't know, after a while, like, you just...
And also, political commentary is so boring to me. I don't like all... I mean, fair play to the people who do it. I don't mean to insult them. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of work and whatever to be people who go scour through the news for talking points and discuss, make videos on every single thing that is being talked about. But most of the things is the same stuff. Was brought up 5-6 years ago. It's the same thing. Someone's been raped by X or whatever. There's another terrorist attack or... there's another stupid war in the Middle East that we won't benefit from. It's the same point over and over.
And especially the trans SJW feminism stuff as well.
How can you talk about it over and over without just thinking this is really boring? And I'm obviously I come into criticism where people say like, you know, it's a retreat. It's cowardly.
It's but, also negative as well. And cowardly, yeah, that's a certain...
I was cowardly for not engaging in these issues as they occur, but I just find them like... It sounds trivial to me. Obviously, it's not trivial that people are suffering in the world. It isn't trivial. But it is trivial the way... like, I don't know all these people. And there are millions of people in the world, and I don't know them, and I got my own... I can't let every single event in current affairs inform my well-being and my views, but I should let certain knowledge about the history of the world inform who I am and how I behave in my life. So that is why I chose to focus on things that are, you know, historical, or old, religious, these kind of things, because they don't go out of fashion. And I like to think that my videos are what content creators call evergreen, in the sense that they're not that they can be watched anytime. It doesn't matter if I made them 3 years ago, they're the same, they're just as valid that now as they are then, because I don't like this idea that this, like, it's part of modernity where we're just caught in this frantic cycle of like the next thing, and like we've hardly even brought up, you know, had time to digest what's happened before the next thing comes along. In fact, that's one of the things I liked about your channel, is because you sometimes discussed a current event well after it had fallen out of the media cycle. And that was interesting, I thought, because you got the last word on the matter for a start. And also you weren't competing to like get, you know, be the first one to comment on it. There wasn't this kind of hyper, you know, desperate sort of time constraint on it. It was just like this event happened. And even if it happened like 6 months ago, you could discuss it as though it happened 60 years ago. It's sort of the historical event with a detached calmness of time, which I prefer.
What I would say is that Morgoth now is making videos often very soon after a current event, a current affair happens, and yet he seems to be able to approach the topic with that same level of detachment and distance, which I find extremely admirable.
He's very good.
Other people have said this. Like, he doesn't need to wait a month before he makes a video about for example, the recent London Bridge terror attack. He makes a video like 2 days or the next day, and it's very thoughtful and insightful. So I very much admire that. But I think you're right. In my case, it used to be like, I think with the Stockholm terror attack, I think I waited a month or 2 months or something before I did that one. But yeah, I think that talking about politics is necessary. It is a part of life.
Got to be
think yeah, but it's not. It takes a certain mentality to be optimal for that, and I don't think I am. And no, I would much rather make things that are, as you say, perennial, and that are about perennial topics like the human condition. That's one of the reasons I want to return to talking about psychology and morality and so on, and also just what it is like to be alive in this age of ours. I mean, that was the whole bloody point of the channel in the first place. A guy pontificating about the age we live in. So that's what I want to return to. But I want to return to it with a bit more, not the defeatism or miserableism that characterized my first year in doing this channel. I want to approach it with a bit of a bit more power and strength and vitality and optimism, because I think that's essential. Of course, the risk for me doing that is that I am quite an emotionally turbulent guy. I do get affected by things, and I go through periods of depression and so on. But
you're meant to be affected by events. That's the point. Like, as a human being, you're meant to be affected by events. But if you're constantly you're supposed to engage with all these different media events, we're not emotionally capable of constantly having genuine emotional reactions to every single thing.
Yeah.
Then the other, so it's just, it becomes inauthentic. You're you start to get used to manufacturing an appropriate emotional reaction to a media event, which is what most of these commentators have to do. I'm not critiquing anyone individual. And I say Morgoth's a great channel as an example of someone doing a really good work on current events and stuff. But I just find it, for reasons you've said, I just want to try and get away from that and try and not be carried away with the stream, with the momentum of the age, and just try to take a step back, in the way you've described as well.
Yeah.
But I wanted to also say one thing about the past year, if I can change the subject slightly, and say two things that have gone that changed this year that I can thank your channel for, or thank you for. One is that last year on Millennial, we had an AMA at the end, and that was that. And then Woz encouraged me. He said, "Why don't you do streams and AMA?" So after then, I did my first Jive Talk stream, and since then I've done many MAAs, and that's now a feature of my channel. And that's partly thanks to Woz, because he told me to do it. And secondly, I got a gift from Woz that I'm using now. He sent me a little device that lets me connect my camera to my computer, which is why I'm in full HD right now. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I see that you're making use of it. I mean, that was my first. That was the converter for getting an HDMI signal from a camera, making it into a USB signal that the computer treats as a webcam. And it's really good because it means that you can use a DSLR camera like Jive is using now and that I'm using now, and it can work for a live stream like this. And I'm really glad that it still works. I got that in early 2016, and yes, I'm glad it's still working.
Yeah, it works great. Yeah, I mean, the only problem I have is that to use the fixed lens, which is the sharpest one I'm using now, I have to have the camera 5 meters away. So the camera is actually 5 meters away. It was only 1 meter away, which is why my head's so big right now, because I can't. I have a small house, so I can't find 5 meter distance. But that's my camera problem. I could use a different lens, but I thought the crispness is the most important thing that people like.
Yeah, I think so. It's great. I'm glad it still works. I'm using a similar thing now, so I didn't need that one anymore. And I think it actually stayed up in Scotland while I was away on the continent in 2017. So it was sort of just lying there unused for a long time. So
maybe I should invest in, for the next year, some more interesting lighting like you have. And I can rival Counterpoints and Philosophy Tube with their bisexual lighting.
This lighting is only for millennial, right? These are Christmas lights. I don't know how if you can see
them properly. No, but you always have coloured lights. You've got purple and red and things like going on.
Yeah.
I don't know who decided to I always thought of it as vaporwave lighting, but someone decided to term it bisexual lighting. Have you heard that term?
I haven't heard of that, no.
Bisexual lighting is what they call it. I don't know why, but I think that's it's a very gay name.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, this is not supposed to be like a gay disco. Someone said it looks like Rose is in a gay disco. It's not a disco.
It looks like.
Exactly. This isn't a disco, gay or otherwise. This is simply Christmas tree lights that have been arranged in a bisexual fashion in the background and to make something Christmassy for people. Yeah, I did the same last year.
Yeah, I did. I had lights up last year, but that was then. This time I can't because the window's on this side of me, so I couldn't really put anything. I can put the book there in the background.
That works. Yeah, okay. It's nice. It's not focused there.
Can't see anything, so it doesn't matter. Oh, I'm knocking everything over.
As for the other thing, the live streaming, live streaming is something that has to be handled very delicately. And when I recommended to you that you do AMAs, it was partly because last year, during my hiatus, I did do AMAs on my live channel again, which something that was just developed by accident one day. And I started doing that weekly, and it was very fun, and you know, people seemed to enjoy it. That was on the MW Live channel. And so that was why when you did Millennial, a lot of people had questions for you that kept coming up. And so I said to you, you know, obviously this would work for you. So that was why I suggested you do it.
Yeah, I definitely got quite a lot. I only did a couple. Usually what I did is a stream on a specific topic. I talk on it and then I'd have an AMA either on that topic or on any. Well, then it wouldn't be literally anything. It would be on that topic. Or sometimes on the first stream I did in January last year was an AMA. And I've taken it down since then, but it was good. It was a good experience. And I've gotten into streaming. I find it more because I always wanted to just have like a specific kind of content on my channel, which is obviously like heavily edited. And I was never intending to be a streamer, but I've realized, changing the YouTube kind of dictates to us to a certain extent what kind of content we're going to create because they promote certain kinds of tools and options. And right now streaming is something they like, and they provide the means that you can make more money off of if you are streaming. So I thought it's a good idea. And actually I've found it quite entertaining. And also it's quite good because sometimes there's a point I want to discuss and I don't have time to edit a video. So when I'm focusing on another video, so I can like be working on a big video project that takes like several weeks to make. And then in between that, I can just do a stream on another subject and keep people entertained and whatever. So yeah, I think I'm glad I'm doing Jive Talk now, Jive Streaming. And I'm glad you gave me that advice. I got onto it. I gave the same advice to my friend, the Golden One. You're going to have him on soon, aren't you?
Because yes.
I saw him a couple of times. I was in Sweden last Christmas, and then I went to Sweden again to deliver a speech at a film festival with the Golden One also. And I said to him, he's got just reached 100,000, and YouTube gave him a plaque, 100,000 subscribers. But he has never done some live streaming or anything like that. So I was like, you should definitely get on it.
Some people take to live streaming, and some people don't. I actually find it. And on the one hand, I started doing my first stuff was videos to the camera, one topic, quite carefully done. It was all very tidy. That's one sort of skill that you learn. But then live streaming is a different thing altogether, especially when there's a guest involved, and especially when there are multiple guests involved. And you need to resist the temptation to just go nuts and talk about anything at all, end up talking about the day you've had, when it's very banal. It's so easy to do that. And I think that one thing that is a major problem is when you get into the habit of doing, and I've seen this happen with people, they could do good content, but instead they fall into the rabbit hole of doing endless 3-hour live streams where they just blether, as we say in Scotland. I don't know if that's an English word as well.
I think so.
And it's just crap. It's banal. So it is something that you've got to be careful of. But, you know, as for me, it's weird. I get very nervous about making proper videos, especially after any length of time away from it. But live streaming, I never get stressed about. It's always, because I think everyone just takes it for granted, it's going to be rough around the edges. It's not going to be perfect. You're going to, you know, drivel here and there. It's fine. So I really enjoy live streaming.
I definitely have less, I feel like there's less pressure, but I also felt the need to remove some of the older streams because I want like people who come to my channel for the first time and they click on it. And I noticed that people who Google Survive the Jive, it was when you Google Survive the Jive for a while, it was all showing only live streams and none of my like heavily edited videos. And I thought that wasn't really representative of me because the live streams were something like to supplement the videos. So I did start taking them down again afterwards because I want people to see the streams as just like, you know, as useful information, and I hope they enjoy them, but they're not the best I can do. They're just like something that I also do as a bonus.
Don't you think also that sometimes they are the best you can do? Because, I mean, like that rant I just did 10 minutes ago about what I want to do for the next few years in Britain. That was completely improvised, but I think I'd actually did pretty well. And if I were to try to write it carefully, write a script about it, it might not be it certainly wouldn't be as spontaneous.
But I would argue that I say that was good, but what you should do then is edit that clip out and put it in a separate video. And
I might well do that.
Yeah, because then people, and then give it a title that people will know what you're going to talk about, like my plan for 2020 or whatever it's going to be called. Because otherwise, people clicking on this video just think it's a stream of you and me chatting, and they won't know that they have to go watch over an hour of content to get to that. So, I think, especially for people who are new to, because I was quite arrogant for quite a long time, make a big mistake where I kept on assuming that the people who watch my videos have already, you know, watched a few of my videos, and that when the reality is that most people who encounter my stuff have never seen anything I've done before. They've got no idea who I am or what I'm about. And so they're judging me on just whatever the first thing they land on is. So I'm trying to make sure that if they're going to land on something, that they see me at my best and not just me, you know, on a not great stream, an okay stream. So I leave a lot of my streams too, but I just wanted to try and curate it like so that some of the best stuff's there. And you I noticed you do that a lot too. Like if you go to the Millennial Rose channel, like the playlists that show up first are the best of this and the best of that, the best of 2019. So you want people. Well,
there
to
won't
see
be much of the best of 2019.
Yeah, I haven't done this. Yeah.
It'll just be the whole hate speech. Which I regret. Yeah, obviously, I'm sad about that. I'm sorry, everyone. It's not. Like, believe me, I would love to have been churning out content, but for many reasons that I've talked about, some I've not talked about, that I had to take a break. And so I'm sorry that the best of 2019 playlist is going to be very bloody sparse. But yeah, in previous years, I've done that.
2020, do you think your content is going to be higher quality than 2018's quality? It's going to be, you're going to be a more well-informed and better content creator.
Yes. I mean, you can
so 2019 was like a hibernation, like a chrysalis period and for evolving into the next stage.
Definitely. I mean, that sounds very indulgent and pretentious, but yeah, it's the truth. I think that for various reasons, about halfway through 2018, when I moved away from, I'd been living somewhere in Germany and I moved to Britain, and I just didn't know what to do. It immediately hit me. I just don't want to film. And I was very nervous about filming and very stressed about it. And I didn't even know what to talk about, let alone what to say about it. So, yeah, I had to. I think it was burnout. I think 2017 was such an incredibly productive year for me that it was only going to be a downhill thing after that, especially after Millennial 2017, which was just fantastically successful. So well, yeah,
up onwards and upwards for the coming year. I hope for both of us.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, to answer your question, yeah, I think you can only get wiser with age, unless you make some sort of bizarre decision to not get wiser and to get stupider. So I think that, I think that my future work will be more rounded. I think it will be more insightful. Yeah, I would say so. But I don't think it will be political, at least not most of the time.
Well, except if you take the perspective we've already mentioned, that everything's political. But
well, possibly. All right. So are there any final things you'd like to say, Survive the Drive? I must say that this hipster stuff is all right. It's been San Pellegrino Melagrano e Arancia, which I'm guessing is grapes and oranges. Pomegranate and orange. Delightful. As for the Parma Violets vaping, it's pretty good, but I think it's going to be an acquired taste.
I put actual holly berries into this. So I've been drinking poison holly berries, but not to worry, dear viewers, because I can only be killed by an enchanted axe blow to the neck. So this no harm to me at all.
Excellent. Good luck. All right, then. Well, I will be back in half an hour with, I believe it's Critical Condition. Let me just confirm that. Yes, Critical Condition, or CC Bucko, who now goes by the name Robin Riley. That's her real name. But anyway, I'm billing her as Critical Condition because I like that name. So I'll be back then, half an hour from now. In the meantime, survive the jive. Thank you for taking part in Millennial 2019. I hope you're back again next year.
Thank you, Robbie Rose. I'll be back next year.
Okay, on whichever platform I'm on by that time, we'll see. And okay, thank you to everyone for watching. Thank you to Jive for participating. And I will see you again in half an hour.